The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 16, Episode 20. This week we heard Bob break down the Richard Allen confessions, and I am back in studio. The whole gang is together, and we are joined by a special guest, Dr. Shiloh from the LA Not So Confidential podcast. And the four of us are here to answer your listener questions and talk about these confessions. But before that, I think we have a quick housekeeping.
Yeah, just a reminder for scheduling stuff. One thing is just to let you guys know we haven't forgotten about season 17. We are, Eric and I are just anxiously and maybe slightly frustratingly waiting for something from the attorney so that we can push forward on that one. We have the first three episodes all outlined, ready to go, but that's still coming, hopefully in the very near future, because we're literally ready to start producing episodes on that one. And also, just let you guys know, scheduling-wise, I told you guys this last week, I'll probably just keep reminding you, the second week of June, we will be off. However those dates fall, there won't be an episode on the, let's call it the 8th and the whatever the Wednesday or the Friday after that is. Just reminding you guys, we'll be off that week. And also with the Underestimated podcast, the next group just started releasing episodes today, I think, on Wednesday. So by Friday, there'll be two out. And that is, this is a super interesting one. They're covering they started off with the investigation into a missing woman named Janice Sanders, who happens to be an alumni graduate of our high school. And then that actually led into a connection with another case. And so that's the one that we're going to be covering now, a different group than what you've been hearing from. So that's starting now. And then finally, Zach, next Friday will be the first one of the Stephen Kraft one, which is, I know you've been waiting for.
Yes, I've been waiting for that one. I'm excited.
Very good. And with that, and Dr. Scott, we had a little scheduling after Dr. Scott selfishly said that he got to be the one to be here this week. I didn't even tell you this, Janet. Scott texted me yesterday. And he's like, oh my God, I forgot what it was. Something came up. I'm not going to be able to make the recording tonight. And I said, well, I have good news, Scott. We're recording tomorrow.
That's such a Scott thing.
Yeah. And then he turned around and he's like, oh, well, I can't do it. He's got a client or something tomorrow night. So luckily, Dr. Shiloh stepped in, got herself caught up to speed. So thanks, Dr. Shiloh, for joining us today.
Of course. Are your listeners so sick of us already?
Never. It's only Mata they get sick of. Just kidding, Bob. Just kidding. No, it's been great. And actually, this is gonna kind of fit right. I'll talk about the end of the episode, how you guys being here throughout this process really plays into what our next week's episode, or this Sunday's coming up episode, is going to be about. But first, we'll just kind of do a round robin as far as what you guys I'll talk to Zach and Janet first, then we'll get into the Shiloh. Your kind of like overall thoughts on the confession. I know you've listened to the confession videos, and then we'll start getting into a little more, you know, probative questions and the listener questions. So, Zach, what did you think?
So you discussed in the episode about the idea of the untrained ear listening, which is 100% me. And I'm glad you started with me because I'm definitely the dullard of this group. And we all know
it's not true.
Give me a break.
So with that being said, it is hard to listen to it. You know, I went and listened to the confessions, and you can see that there is clearly something off with Richard Allen. But at the same point, to the untrained ear, he does say it. He says, "I killed Abby and Libby." That's hard to get around.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of what's happening for me as an, you know, someone that doesn't read anything, that's doesn't read body language, doesn't listen to the words exactly, like, it's hard to get around when someone specifically says, "I killed them."
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned in the episode a couple of times, you said, this isn't a confession because it doesn't say how it happened, where it happened, why it happened. Is that something you would normally see in a confession to a loved one?
Well, and I try to caveat that point. Is that because the confessions are a tricky thing for me in this. And that's why I try to, two things that I try to make sure I made clear. One is that I don't fault the jury for convicting based on that. Like for jurors, just your everyday set of peers sitting there listening to someone say the words, "I killed Abby and Libby."
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, I absolutely get it. Why they did that. Then I also said, so there's kind of two elements for me when I'm doing this, the statement analysis, you know, when I'm looking at a confession to determine, is this a legit confession? Is it a false confession? Is it just somebody just trying to get attention? Whatever I'm looking for, is there a narrative? Am I hearing the who, what, when, where, and why? Can they articulate it? And if I'm like interviewing somebody doing that, you want to get them to kind of tell the story and kind of tell the story backwards and, you know, a couple different ways to make sure things are lining up. And does it fit the evidence, right? Because that's what you want to check, right? Does their confession match the crime scene evidence? Are we getting guilty knowledge from them? Didn't have any of that stuff. So on that technical basis, it doesn't check the boxes of a confession for me. But the caveat to that is this wasn't an interview.
Right.
Right. So it's like, would I expect all of that to a family member? No. So it's not like, you know, this was clearly a coerced false confession. It's not that. It's just like, to me, like this doesn't do anything for me. There's no meat there for me to work with. Not that I would expect there to be in a phone call like that, but so there is that difference. I would not expect it to be a confession like that to a family member.
Cause that's what I was thinking the most was the idea of like, are they really going to tell a family member, a wife, a brother, a sister, a mother, why they did it or how they did it? Or,
yeah.
You know, I mean, if they're confessing to them, you're breaking down, you're saying, I did this awful, awful thing.
Mm-hmm.
They probably don't want you to go in detail. You probably don't want to go in detail with them.
Right. And for me, it was just like, it kind of makes it like neutral. Like I can't say this is a legit confession based on these things because there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I can't say, well, this is a false confession because we didn't hear these things, because you wouldn't expect to hear them. So I hate to say this, but for something this important, but like for me, it's like, it's a nothing burger for me. I couldn't convict based on this.
Right. And I can understand that. I just, it's hard as just an average listener to hear him say those words and then not put any weight behind it.
Sure.
All right. Janet?
I thought that I had listened. I mean, did they play some of that stuff in the, I don't know. Somehow I thought I had listened to some of these confessions before, but I guess
some of the news broadcasts played clips of them.
Okay. Right, all right. So I had heard stuff. Okay. I had heard some stuff, but in this particular case, I just didn't know if I had it in me. So I'm sorry that I didn't do my full homework when I did listen to your episode first with the intention of knowing like, okay, my priority is I want to make sure I have time to listen to the episode. That's more important than whether I can get to the actual tapes. So I prioritized that. And then when I was listening to you describe what his wife is going through, I was like, I can't do it. Like, I was so disturbed last week that I just thought, I just don't think I can do this. So, and I know Shiloh will be proud of me for taking care of myself emotionally, but I really just, I was like, I just can't. So my feelings about this episode are based on your descriptions and your takeaway and not on my own experience of listening. And I mean, Look, again, having followed the case while it was happening and understanding what the conditions were in, the conditions and the sort of sense from the defense about what his mental state was, I also have never been able to accept them as like critical evidence that would make me feel comfortable going, okay, I feel very confident that this person is responsible. It's one of the things that makes this case so heartbreaking is that there are just, I mean, I can't imagine they're not going to be teaching this case in law school for decades to come. Yeah. It's just a very, very unique case with very interesting, very disturbing, extenuating circumstances about, you know, patient treatment by a doctor and how we, you know, behave in the prison system and all of that kind of stuff. And it's upsetting because, of course, one of the things about it is that we lose sight of the girls in part because we have to, because this is critical stuff that has to be analyzed. But let us never forget the two young women at the center.
Absolutely. So, Shiloh, what was your takeaway after? I know you listened to the or watched the video where you could listen to the whole confessions. What did you think?
I listened to your episode first because I didn't know that I was going to be on here. So just in my regular rotation, listened to that and then went back and listened to the confessions a couple of times. I think just high level takeaways. Almost every phone call is so different. There's something to say about each of those times and how he's presenting. But I mean, maybe it was the right decision, Janet, not to listen, because I think, you know, with there's so much empathy for Kathy. And you know, very quickly in there, you get this feeling that she talks to him when he's more like despondent and confused, like someone who has lived with a chronically mental ill family member or a developmentally delayed family member, or even like an addict, you know, that is just under the influence a lot. Just where you talk to someone who's has problems with sense making, where you kind of slow down. You try to be steady, you try to guide them, you know, gently, but also you can like hear how intensely frustrating it is for her because she's wanting to guide him in the right way. And like, kind of like, how do you get someone's mind straight to the phone, right? Like that's the desperation you kind of feel with her.
Yeah.
And like, hey, we shouldn't be talking about the case on the phone. And then it's like, well, I don't want to sound guilty like he's guilty because I'm saying that. Like,
right.
So much feeling, like listening to her. Ugh.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Speaking of Kathy, that's one of the things that I wanted to really ask you about is one of the things for me that was an indicator for me that something was very wrong with Richard Allen. Because with you know, when I did the episode, I went through and I compared it to her trial testimony about, you know, what was going on with him at the time on the dates when this stuff was happening.
Right. The doctor's testimony, right?
Yeah.
Not testimony. Kathy.
But without that, even is when I compared, did you watch the interrogation videos that we talked about in the previous episodes?
I didn't watch them all the way through. I had seen some of them before.
Okay. Because one big thing that I noticed, Dr. Scott noticed, is there was this like, the thing that he got the most upset about and the thing that he seemed to be most bothered by was how things were affecting Kathy. Yep. Like he was angry about that. He was very protective of her. That's what was upsetting him. So one of the big things that jumped out at me in this was he had no reaction at all to Kathy being upset. And it was just like, that doesn't track with what I felt like I had established as a baseline for him, that was like a big deal for him was that Kathy was okay.
Well, the first call he does, the one on November 14th, mm-hmm. So this call to me, if this had been written down, like instead of listening to it, if this was things that like he had written, right? I don't want to upset you anymore. I don't want you to worry about me. Let everyone know how much I love them. I might see you just one more time. This, I would call this a suicide note.
Mm.
Like
right.
Textbook.
Yes.
Everything he's saying is like, yes, do you love me? Basically, because I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Is everyone going to, like, he's making peace with everything. Mm-hmm. Take care of the family. Take care of yourself. Okay. Like, it's goodbyes. And you can hear the burdensomeness oozing out of him. And
right.
When we look at it, especially there's one theory, Joyner's theory of suicide risk assessment. We look at three things. And if they're present, like, this is very high risk. So it's feeling like a burden to others. It's feeling alone. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is not being afraid to die. Basically, you have, and he, if he has some suicidal ideation in the past, then generally that's why those folks are always, you know, pretty high risk, because they have come to terms with the fact that suicide is at least on the table for them. We call it acquired capacity. So essentially, like, you know, maybe the rest of the population is really squeegee about thinking about ever taking their lives. These folks have really like wrapped their head around it already. And mm-hmm. I feel like those three points are there for him. And so
in that one, mm-hmm. in that call, no, but that was before that he was only been in prison for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
The first time he talked to her, it was before he, you know, had all the psychosis issues that he had later. And I felt like that when, you know, not to have an understanding at the level that you do, but to me that felt like, cause I didn't catch like the idea that it's almost like suicidal thoughts, but to me it seemed like in that one, I just really felt like he was just like, I'm doing this to take the burden. I'm going to just say this and end it or whatever to take the burden off of you, because there was a lot of that. Like, you know,
well, in that one, garbage. He's not so much saying like, I don't think he says that he did it in that first one. So it's just, it's not sounding right. Like I'm going to confess to this to take the burden off of you.
But it's like
sounding
trying to find
very
a way.
Suicidal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I think it's hard to wrap our heads around also like this notion that suicidal people don't want to die. They just want to end the intense psychological pain. And that's right. The option that they have come up with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hearing a lot of that in that first phone call in November.
Right. And then we jump to January, and those are the are not January, April.
Right.
You know, those are the ones where to me it seemed like that was like he just seemed to not care. Like he wasn't affected the way I read. Like he just wasn't affected by her emotions in that. So and that's when he starts the confessing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the first one on April 2nd, or no, that one's with his mom. There's one on April 2nd with his mom,
mm-hmm.
and he's coherent. He's almost jovial, I would say, like the beginning and emotionally regulated, right? Like having kind of normal conversations with her about the weather and church.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's when she talks about like starting to go back to church herself that he breaks down and says that he's accepted Jesus Christ and, you know, talking about the Bible and that maybe we'll be together again eventually. To me, that sounds like appropriate emotionality. Like she is connected with something that he is connected with. And that's mm-hmm. really, you know, touching to him or making him sad. I almost got like, it's making him sad that his mom had to go back to church because of him, even mm-hmm. though it's like a source of strength and support. Like someone who is feeling suicidal or feeling intense guilt or both, everything is like, it's my fault, right? They're broken. Yeah. They're the center of all of that. But yeah, the first one with Kathy is like a day later. And then yes, the robotic, despondent, just like he's throwing a statement out, and you're right. Like there's no soothing like he was doing to her in those interviews, the interrogation tapes.
Yeah. He's just like, I did it. And she's crying. And he's just like, I did it. And then obviously there's other elements of that too, to discuss, you know, the, well, I think I did it, or what if I did do it? I don't know what's going on. I'm losing my mind. But that was the big thing to me was it just that he's not in this normal state of mind, whatever that means.
And it's interesting, like in that call, again, this is the one on April 3rd. It's the first time he says, I did it. I killed Abby and Libby. And then she comes back and says, no, you didn't. And then you can hear him sigh. It's almost like a sigh of frustration. Like I don't want to put words in his mouth, but like, I tried to say the thing and it didn't work. Like she didn't hang up on me and tell me, well, you know, never call me again. Mm. He's just like, and then he goes, oh, I'm trying here.
Yeah.
I thought that was so, again, let's borrow from Scott. I thought it was notable. I didn't know what it was, mm-hmm. but I was like, that's so interesting. But he uses a lot of those hesitation words like, evidently I did it. Maybe I did it. I think I did it. I don't know. To me, that's ambivalence.
Yeah. Did you, is still that kind of like really 30,000 foot view of it? After hearing all of the different versions of the confessions on those calls, did you walk away feeling like these are legitimate confessions? Did you, like, what was your overall kind of viewpoint on it?
My overall is that it just feels very concrete. Like it's a canned statement. Now, is that canned because he's like, this is how I'm going to work myself up to say it to Kathy and that's it? Or is it, here's what I think happened, or here's what I have to tell her so she will just go on and live her life and leave me alone? I don't know. It just, it feels like very simple and canned for his psychosis and confusion. He just sticks to that one point. Like, it's just what, I don't know. It's hard to explain how he just kind of sticks to just like almost literally the term, I did it. I killed them. Mm-hmm. If that, there's like no other variation to it. And again, like you guys already said, I get it. Like, you know, I can't even imagine what Kathy's thinking. It had to go through her mind. Oh shit, what if he did, right? We would all think that, I think, mm-hmm. at some point, right? Especially he's saying this repeatedly. And I would argue that maybe she would want to ask him or even ask him to quiz him to see, does he even know what he's saying? But she knows she can't go there.
Right.
And then I'm thinking, like, with all of this, was the prison or the defense, or I'm sorry, the prosecution not listening to these calls? And why did they not call him in and be like, hey, is there something you want to say? Like, tell us.
Yeah, and get it on the
interesting
record.
Interesting question. Like, interesting question.
Well, probably because he's represented, so they would have had to contact his attorney, and his attorney would have said, no, we're not doing that. But then again, too, his attorney also then would have had to be aware of the fact that at some point through discovery, he's just confessed on the phone, like, multiple times together. But it's interesting how I hadn't thought about that, how you said that, like, that sigh, where it's just like, oh, I tried it, and it didn't, because as I'm, like, thinking back to them in my mind now, all the calls kind of go that way, right? It's always like, no, I did it.
He starts out with that, right? Like, almost the second she answers the phone towards the end calls.
And then as it goes on, it's almost like he gets exhausted with it. And that's when he's like, I don't know. I think I'm losing my mind. I don't know what's going on. It's always like putting it right now as I sit here in the context. As you say that, it's almost just like, I built up everything in me so I can just do this and get it over with.
Right, right.
It didn't work. And then I'm just like, all right. Yeah, I'm out of it. You know, like, gives up on what he's trying to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure. But there is that, you called it robotic, like that very monotone, that there's just no affect in his voice a lot of the time. And a lot of time he's just really kind of quiet, and Kathy's kind of filling the space to feel it out, like what's going on. Yeah, it's just, there's like some weird verbiage in here too. I don't know.
Five years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Just to kind of put it into context also, like, to kind of pay service to someone's question, I'll lump mine in as well. So Sarah says, do we know whether Richard Allen was medicated when incarcerated? And if so, what meds? He had been on SSRIs prior to his arrest, correct? Did they continue that treatment as normal in prison? Do we know? If this has already been answered, apologies and disregard. Sarah, I'm glad you asked, because that leads us also into whether we have the exact answer for that or not, whether or not. Like, what's the takeaway on whether the affectation can be attributed to the forced medication, or does the timeline work that affectation is the part of the psychotic break potentially, or part of the malingering that she claims. Like, can we wrap our head around that? Do we have enough information to know about like medication and how that plays in?
I don't know. And Shiloh might know what the medication was, but also I just want, like, part of what you had in your question, Janet, answers the listener's question, the fact that yes, he was on med, because it said in Walla's testimony that there was a point where they started forcing, I don't remember the term they used, but essentially like non-voluntary, they were like making him take medication at some point.
Yeah. We don't know the medication. And if, you know, it was just a continuation of SSRIs, you know, that could be for depression, that could be to help sort of turn down the hallucinations of the psychosis. But I mean, his affect could be because of insomnia. You know, if he's not sleeping, if the medication's not working, if he's not eating, if he's just not getting the standard of care that he should be getting to address some of the confusion. And not all confusion is due to medication or to a mental health situation. I mean, so much of it can be biological that we need to rule out first, because there's so many medical and biological conditions that result in confusion that we always, you know, rule that out first. I mean, it could be anything. It could be a head injury. It could be a number of things. So
did you get the feeling, though, that he was in his right mind, that he was like stable enough to be making decisions like this, having conversations like this? Or did you like something was off, regardless of we know what it was?
I mean, something was off. I don't know how to answer. Like, was he in his right mind for this? I mean, anyone's in the right mind to have a conversation with anyone. Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard question to answer.
I just feel, I guess what I mean is, like, if this was a, and again, I know that you're not going to diagnose somebody based on a YouTube recording, but like, I'd recommend you don't go like buy a house, sign important documents right now. Like, you're not, you know, like something's off right now.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, you know, the term like sanity came up. It came up when we did our episode and looked at Dr. Walla's piece on this. You know, sanity is a legal term. It's not even like something that we would jot down in our notes at all. Mm-hmm. You would just jot down observations, like, what are you observing in this person? And if you're treating them like you're doing a course of therapy, you may diagnose them. But all, and I can get into it if you want to, as far as like the difference between treating someone who's on pretrial, like Alan was, and treating someone who's been convicted already, it's a very different thing. And your notes would be very different as well.
We will get into that in a minute. But what did you say, Zach?
Haldol?
That was Haldol. So somebody said that Lynn said that they gave him two doses of Haldol. And then she also points out that, you know, as far as his mental state, like, his only human interactions were with guards and Dr. Walla.
Yeah.
During that whole time. I guess we can start going through the listener questions, Janet, and then we'll see if there's anything else we want to discuss after that, because I know we want to dig into some of the Dr. Walla stuff while we have a...
Yeah, let's go to Christina. Christina says, just so we can get this clarification, Christina says, I have a really basic threshold question that I haven't heard the answer to in any coverage of the Delphi case. Why was Dr. Walla not bound by patient confidentiality? Why was she able to reveal the content of her conversations with Richard Allen to the police or anyone?
Yeah, so that's twofold. One is that when you are a forensic psychologist seeing a client in, let's just take this, a correctional setting, as a psychologist, your client is the correctional entity, like Department of Corrections or whatever. I know that sounds really weird, but that's who your primary client is. The person that you are seeing is your secondary client. As a part of them seeing you, they will sign something saying, I know you have open confidentiality with me, especially pretrial. I know that's a very short answer, and I can expand on that later. The other flip side, if you're referring to testifying and revealing all this on the stand, when you go into court and you are subpoenaed to talk about a client, you will say, I am asserting privilege, meaning I am not allowed to talk about this. And then the judge can look at you and go, I order you to talk about this. And now you have to talk about it. So technically, everyone out there, your records can be subpoenaed to court and your therapist can be called to testify. And if a judge deems it, that you have to break confidentiality and it's not a mandated reporter type issue, like no one's life is in danger or anything like that, it can definitely happen. It's incredibly rare, but it can definitely happen.
So there was nothing out of bounds with her testifying about the things he said?
Oh, no, no.
No, but it's interesting what you said about like signing something, acknowledging that you know that you're not about to confide in someone who will keep your secret. Because like, for example, Nancy says, would Richard Allen have been made aware his counseling sessions could be used in court? If he's had a lot of mental health issues, he may know a bit about doctor-patient confidentiality and not realize she could testify against him. So then you get into the whole framework of like, what was his frame of mind when he signed that? Was he in a state that he truly understood even what he was signing and that it could mean that he would be, his confidence would be, you know, would not be exclusive to between him and his doctor?
It's all very messy. I will say when you are treating someone who has not been convicted yet pretrial, you have to be specially trained on this because what you are treating or what you are assessing for is purely how they're presenting. And with pretrial clients, as you can imagine, the most common things are anxiety, depression, and possibly suicidality, right? If someone is facing charges, that is all that you are, quote unquote, treating or trying to stabilize. If somebody has something like psychosis, you would refer to a psychiatrist to be able to perhaps assess if medication needs to be given, but you're not treating the psychosis, right? So you should not be trying to treat, I use that in air quotes, because hallucinations are really only going to be treated with medication. You're treating the anxiety that might come from those hallucinations. Someone who has psychosis could have hallucinations and delusions, which is a false belief. As a psychologist, as a mental health therapist, you are never treating a false belief because you're not ever going to change that or fix it. You are treating the anxiety that comes with it, the distress that that person is in because of what they're believing or what they're seeing or what they're hearing. So at the very minimum, you're doing that. You're trying to keep them stable until they go to trial, and you absolutely steer clear of anything that could impact their case, anything that could get you called on the stand, anything that could jeopardize, you know, something going against them. You have to have those conversations ahead of time. Hey, we're not going to tread into this territory about your case. Some people just want to vomit at the mouth anyway, and you gently guide them away from that. And you a million times admonish them about the limits of confidentiality that essentially they have none.
So
what if you're too busy going on to Reddit and telling everyone everything that you know and asking them to tell you? Sorry, Bob, go ahead.
So, for example, let's say having your client call their wife to tell them that they committed the murder while they're sitting there with you, that's perhaps frowned upon?
Yeah. So just to let the audience know, so I treated pretrial offenders in the community, people who are out on bail and going through their cases. So they, as part of their pretrial agreement, they agreed to come to therapy to, again, just treat the anxiety and the depression. Dr. Scott, he did that as well with me for a few years. And then he worked in a county jail. So he saw people incarcerated, but pretrial, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking like 15 years or so of working with folks in this situation. That is a private conversation that I would never want to get myself into because I am now automatically roped into the legal part, right? Especially if he's confessing. If he's like, hey, can I call my wife and tell her I love her while I'm sitting right here? Maybe, but why? Like, that's private. That's between mm-hmm. them. So we said this in our episode that we touched on this. What I would do is say, I understand talking to your wife can be really distressing. Why don't you have your phone call with her? We'll set up a session for right afterwards. We can process it, talk about how it felt, you know, how all of those things. I don't need to be there for that. And if he didn't feel like he was in a place where he could call her without his therapist, that's also something to talk about and process on the front end and get him to a point where he hopefully can, right? So,
and we just have no information about why she would be there.
Can you explain why, or not why, but who? So you mentioned that, you know, in pretrial, you constant admonishment about the limitations of doctor-patient confidentiality, and that you don't talk about the case. Is that like, when you say that as a, as like a rule, like is this a law? Is there a governing body that like makes these rules for you guys? Like, where does that come from? That those limitations that you discussed?
There is not a governing body that speaks to that. So our governing body essentially is, you know, for us is the state of California, the California Board of Psychology. So they don't break that down for forensic psychologists. There are some policies and guidelines for forensic psychologists, but even the field of forensic psychology is so huge, like correctional or working with offenders is really like its own niche. It is something at the places that Scott and I have worked has been policy, you know, standard of practice for the people working there where you are trained in it. And we were interns ourselves in these settings. So we were trained on it. I then went on to train the interns in these things. What you're doing is, yes, the Department of Corrections or parole or whoever is your main client, but it doesn't mean you don't give a shit about the person sitting in front of you. You want to protect them too, right? And you want to remain as neutral as possible. And even if they did heinous things, you don't want to lend to either side of, you know, influencing guilt or innocence. So yeah, that's a great question. There's nothing that like would be a hard and fast like guideline to be like, oh, she violated this or what have you. I do want to address Susan's comment or question here. Can we give any grace to her because she typically saw prison post-conviction patients? Yeah, I think like if she was working in the prison, that is absolutely who she was used to working with, in a sense that like, okay, they can talk about whatever because they have already been convicted. So since this was such a specialized case, absolutely she and her team should have been like, all right, let's get together. Let's discuss how we're going to handle this. And this is probably the most high profile thing we'll ever see. Mm-hmm. So we really need to have everything buttoned up. And given Dr. Walla the support, if she had never worked with a pretrial person before, that she deserved, like she deserved guidance and support and the appropriate training for it and what we call consultation, which is just like bouncing this off other professionals to make sure you're not making decisions in a vacuum.
Well, I have a strange question. So the confession that appears to be the most damning confession across the board is the one that he gave to Walla that's in her notes.
Not in her notes. She destroyed the notes.
Okay, that she has presented.
Yeah.
So if a client or patient presents you with that, what is your obligation to turn that over immediately? Or, I mean, is that something you have to do?
Okay, so for a pretrial client, if they admitted a crime to me in session, so yeah, that would be something that during our session, I would say, you know, I've warned you or what have you, and you still said this thing. This now means that I have to talk to your parole agent or I'm sorry, pretrial services officer or whoever that is. And we're going to have a conversation about this because this is something that I can't hold in confidentiality. So it wouldn't be that like I write it in my notes and then just, well, maybe someone discovers it one day. I would automatically call the pretrial services officer and say, hey, you know, in my case, when I saw sex offenders, this person told me that they actually went to a school while school was in session and watched kids or whatever. Because the whole idea of breaking that confidentiality in regard to somebody talking about offending is that you're trying to keep the community safe while they are theoretically back out in the community. Now, if he's talking about a crime that he already did, that being that he's on pretrial services, that is still open to confidentiality. We also had the weird situation where we had offenders that we were treating that had already been convicted of something, say possession of, child sexual exploitative images of children, right? We did not want them admitting to previous crimes that they had talked about because then we would have to report that as well because potentially that child could still be in danger. It was never reported, what have you. But if they were in a private practice setting, that also throws another loophole in there. But I don't know. I don't need to get into that per se for this case.
So it sounds like there's enough gray area there That's kind of what I'm getting as far as that. Now we're going to get into some of her other behaviors too, but it seems like as far as like the way they're supposed to, you know, all the things you said that a pretrial psychologist should be doing, and whether they're required to report or can report what somebody mm-hmm. says in that setting. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's squishy enough that she was able to like get away with all this without like creating any like obvious violations. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it is gray enough. I think she should have been trained better from the information I have, right? And I think that there should have been more steering away from having these, even touching on these conversations with him, and certainly not sitting in on a conversation. And God forbid, like there was any guiding to that conversation. Like that would be huge, a huge, huge, huge no-no. When you're treating somebody, just sitting there with them can be guiding. You have to be aware of your presence and influence on your client all of the time. So, you know, not just that it's a privacy issue or a confidentiality issue when she's sitting there during a phone call, but if your client is very confused and or psychotic, what if they're thinking, if it's a paranoid delusion, oh, I have to confess because she's sitting here staring at me. I mean, you have to think about the influence that you could be having on someone.
To that point, he said in that call, when she said, you have to stop, he said, I cannot stop. I have someone sitting right here with me, listening.
It's so infuriating like, to not know out loud. More about. Yeah, like, what does it mean? What is the exact circumstance we are talking about here? It's, yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, so that could be all in his head, right? Of like, I have to say these things because she's here watching me. And God forbid there be like any other influence, you know, guards telling him he has to confess or whomever. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Since it's hard to say a lot of these hypotheticals, let me put it in a different framing. If you were Richard Allen's psychologist, mm-hmm. here and there, and somehow you already dropped the ball and he's calling his wife in front of you and he's confessing and you're hearing him say, I can't stop because I have somebody sitting here listening to me, what would your react? Would you just let the conversation keep going, or what would your reaction to that be?
If it was safe to do so, I'd probably remove myself right in the middle of it, or tell him while he's on the phone with her, like ask, like, would it be more comfortable if I leave, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Because you can't just ignore it and pretend like you didn't hear it. It's okay to have some sort of intervention right then and there. If he has said something, it would get my spidey senses up of like, oh shit, am I influencing like this conversation with her? And maybe I don't want to be listening to this anyway. And it's recorded, so someone's going to hear it. So I don't like have to put myself as the witness here. But even say like, I'll just be outside the door. We'll talk about, you know, how you're feeling when you get off the phone, and remove yourself from the situation is a totally appropriate thing to do.
That was the thing that got me as I'm listening to it, because I'm trying to like, right, imagine what's happening in that room right now. And so I'm like, mm-hmm. just trying to imagine like she's sitting there and she's hearing him confess and she hears him say, I can't. And he says it like, I can't stop because I have someone sitting here listening to me. And I'm just like trying to imagine like, what is she doing then? Is she just like, okay, keep going? Because you would expect to hear like, Richard, I'm going to step out. You don't have to say anything because of me. You know, it's like something. But like, there's just still just silence from her. She's just sitting there, just continuing to watch it happen.
That goes to my question, which is just to be very clear, lest anyone get an impression that we don't mean to issue. We don't have any actual evidence that the person, if indeed there is a person there at all, we have no evidence that it's her, correct?
No, we do.
Like, it could have been. We do. She said, I sat in on his calls to his wife.
She testified that she was sitting there during that call.
During that call. Okay, great.
Yep.
All right.
Do you want to move on to another listener question?
I'd love to. Sarah says, what evidence is there that Dr. Wallet went into the counseling sessions with Richard Allen believing him to be guilty of the crimes, or that she was trying to help the police make a case against him? I don't think we're even saying that. Like, I don't have any reason to believe that she went in thinking that he was guilty, and I don't really even know if she coached him into confessing. Just speaking personally, and obviously I'm not the expert, but unfortunately, every other piece of information about how she handled things is what sort of casts tremendous doubt on any and all of her involvement for me. She could have been advocating for him, for as much as I know. You know, she could have been going online and being like, I really think this guy's innocent. I really think Keegan Klein did it. I don't know. I just find her behavior to be egregious, regardless of what her opinion about his innocence or guilt was.
Yeah, like I'm not saying that she was doing that. Like I said, there's no evidence she was doing that. My issue is because a lot of the things we're talking about and we're going to get into is like she just doesn't have credibility to me. Like she was doing right. things, especially like we're hearing Dr. Shiloh talk about how these things should have been handled compared to how they were handled, and then all the other stuff. It's just like this is to me. On its face, just isolating her, like, I'm not saying she was trying to frame Richard Allen. I'm saying she's not a credible witness, in my opinion.
Same.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Anna, I hope I'm saying it right, but you spoke about it a little bit before, Shiloh, and I just wanted to kind of pay tribute to Anna's experience of listening as well. This is a longer post, but to kind of boil it down, a piece of it is that she felt that she did kind of get almost like a suicide by cop vibe, like that his mental state could just, if he could just do something to make it all end, to make it all go away, that would be a big priority for her. And she felt like she was perceiving that as she was listening to him talk. I don't know if she's specifically referring to that one call, but that it becomes part of this bigger picture that is, you know, my only way out is now to do whatever it is that's going to like put an end to this, which kind of calls to mind the whole, I mean, that's when I really knew I wasn't going to be able to listen to these tapes. Is when Bob, you described him as saying, I had a dream, I had to let you go. Like, I heard that and I was like, mm-mm, yeah. I'm out. I'm tapping out. I'm not going to be able to listen to that. I'm just not going to be able to listen to her crying and him saying that. All of that just felt very upsetting to me. Is that same call or is that a different call, Shiloh? Do you guys remember Bob? Like, where?
Well, I think what the listener is saying is like, if I'm reading it, if I'm understanding it right, is not that it's necessary like he's going to say something to get the cops to kill him, but like more so just to like, I'm going to figure out which is what she said, right? So I need to do something to put an end to this pain, whether it's the pain for him, yes. The pain for his wife, the pain for his loved one. Like, I'm just going to like, if I just say I did it, then this stops and all this horrible stuff stopped. Or is it, you know, if I just say I did it, they'll let me finally have visitation and like whatever thing it was. I am in no position of authority to speak to that, but my just personal human opinion is just that, yeah, like it felt like that to me. Like it seemed to me that he was saying these things as a means to some kind of an end. But Shiloh is the expert here.
Yeah, I don't quite understand the suicide by cop comment. I don't think she means it literally.
She doesn't. Yeah, she didn't mean that. She was just saying like, I'm in an environment where even if I can't control my life, like if I can get someone else to end it for me somehow, whether it's the death penalty or that I can change my circumstance so that it becomes more plausible or possible for me to end my life, that there it becomes the sort of like okay, how can I, what do I need to do to just change this so that the end of my life can come faster?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. Again, just like, okay, how can I get Kathy to, and the rest of my family to move on and just not worry about me anymore? So
yeah, I felt like the framework of that is there to where it, like a suicide by cop meeting, I'm willing to do a bad thing to get a result that's going to relieve some kind of pain, right? In this, if it's like, if the thing is, I'm just going to confess, and the result of that will be, it will relieve Kathy's pain. It'll relieve my family's pain, going to relieve the victim's family's pain. It'll relieve, you know, whatever the thing is, relieve me not, you know, being in solitary confinement, whatever the thing is that, like, that's what I took as kind of like on a, you know, an analogous, you know, kind of the basic sense of that. I'm just going to do a thing that's going to cause a result that is what I'm looking for.
Yeah. In working with a lot of pretrial folks and some people I saw pretrial, they went to prison for a few years and then I saw them post conviction, even for some incredibly horrendous things, nothing as awful as this. I will definitely say, spouses stick by their man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously she is like unconditionally telling him she loves him, that it does not matter. And a lot of people are able to go, you know what? Maybe I'll go to prison for the rest of my life, but my wife still loves me. She'll eventually be able to visit me. She's telling me she cares for me. I can keep some semblance of, you know, a relationship and in touch with the outside world through her and other family members. That is when someone doesn't have anything because of prison, and I'm sure, like, Bob, you have seen this time and time again with the cases you've worked, that becomes like their, okay, this is as best it's going to be. I might be in prison, but I have my loved ones still.
Yeah. And that reminded me of something else that I wanted to ask you. I mentioned it in the episode, but one thing that I thought was strange, and I don't know what, if any, meaning to put on it, is the fact that, you know, when Kathy's telling him, like, if you're going to talk like this, I can't talk to you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like there was only a binary choice there for him. It's either I don't get to talk to you, or I don't talk to you, or I continue to say I did it every time I talk to you. And I just thought that was so strange. Like, you've done it, you've confessed, you said the thing. Why does it just seemed odd to me that it wasn't an option for him? Like, okay, now that I've done that, it's going to make it easier on you. We can continue just having normal conversations. I just won't talk about that anymore. But that would seem to be not on the table for him. Did you take anything away from that?
Again, I think it just lends to it being very like concrete thinking for him at that time, and not speaking to guilt or innocence, but just like, this thing didn't work. She's not biting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and he's just like kind of in a this or that mindset, which to me just says like he doesn't have the full cognitive functioning to be able to think about the other options there.
Right.
I also hear her frustration on that end too, because, you know, she's just so upset that she's saying like, I can't talk to you like this anymore. And of course, like, as soon as she hangs up that phone, she's going to be like, that's not true. Like, of course I can keep talking to him, but like, it's just so upsetting to her. And again, like, he just kind of has no response for her pain.
Can we talk about the confession to Walla for a second?
Yeah, because I just realized as you were saying that we're almost an hour in and we haven't gotten to the real meaty part that I want to hear Dr. Shiloh weigh in on is the, and I'll just leave the table open to you, like the general ethics of kind of, I think you're wanting to talk about the specifics of the confession. I'll get to that in just a minute, but if Shiloh, if you want to talk about, because I know you guys did a whole episode and you can share it with people like how they find that episode too, but kind of your take on Walla's ethical behavior in all of this, like in general, the things that you have concerns about, it would be, instead of hearing me yammer on about it here, somebody that actually works in the field to discuss that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we touched enough on like, okay, did she have enough training and experience and guidance to know what to do with a pretrial client? We talked about that enough. In terms of just, again, knowing how high profile this is, you should be absolutely walking on eggshells with your behavior in terms of making sure you're not breaching confidentiality by talking to anyone in your personal life, including pillow talk with whomever you share a bed with, to the wider, you know, World Wide Web true crime community. So yeah, it's Scott and I found it shocking. I mean, you should be like huddled down in a cave if you're going to be the person treating this person. And I talk about it in our episode. I was actually fully treating someone when their case became high profile.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have a lot of like lead time to think about it, but our whole team was like, buckle down. Like, we need to button everything up, fine tooth comb, and, you know, see where this is going to go. So in a sense, I've been there, and it was incredibly shocking. Also, and Scott and I talk about this too, like, if you are a forensic psychologist, you probably love true crime, and that has, you know, brought you to your career interest in some sense. You have to separate that. You have to compartmentalize that, right? Because I would come home at night afterwards and be like, wow, this is really fucked up and surreal, but holy shit, like, this is so crazy. This is happening in my life. Like, not finding glee in it, but like, whoa, like, and I had to testify in the trial. The client ended up representing themselves in the trial, so I had to be cross-examined by them. Like, it was nutso. But, you know, I still couldn't say anything about it, and nor would I, that would do anything to reveal, you know, confidentiality or lead someone to find out what that case was, even though I testified and it's public record.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still like, no. And you know what? I've consulted with people on it, just making sure what I can say, what I can't say, even though I had been doing the job for a long time by then. So again, like, there's twofold. There's, you definitely should not be breaching confidentiality and putting info out into the world that you have, that is special knowledge that you have because you're a part of this. You also should not be taking information back to your client, because you are now tainting the pool of their mental health. What is that going to do to them? We're the same, like, do no harm, right?
Right.
And we are not the judges to be able to say like, no, this will make them feel better. That's not okay to come and say, hey, you have a ton of support online. Let his wife tell him that. That is not right. Your job.
And even like being involved, and you kind of touched on that, but like, just like being involved in these online discussions about the case while you're treating them, like, that just, like, for me, that just crossed a major, major line. And then, yeah, and then not, I mean, disclosing that.
No. I mean, if treating psychologist wants to go home and peruse it, great. Go ahead, be anonymous, be a voyeur, look at all of it that you want. But make sure when you step into that prison the next day, you don't say a peep about it to your client, and you just do your job like you're supposed to do it. And if you cannot like compartmentalize those two, ask to be removed from, you know, have that client removed from your caseload. That, yeah. You know, we have counter transference and weird things that happen all the time where we might just have to dish off a client to someone else because of something personal with us, like our stuff. And that's totally okay too. That's always an option.
Well, and to me too, there's like any one of the things in a vacuum is problematic. But then when I look at, when I, you know, I said earlier that in my opinion, she is not credible when it comes to like the professionalism and whatever you're compartmentalizing and if you're able to do it. If you then add into that behavior that she's actively engaging in these discussions, and then add to that, that she went out and what ultimately sounds like got her fired, is like, like hacking into the DOC computer system to get more information about the case. I think I heard she was like looking up information on Keegan Klein and stuff through, because I think what got her was like a HIPAA violation based on some of that stuff. Like, and I like pair those together, like, it seems to me she is not compartmentalizing it. She's just digging deeper and deeper and deeper. She's like, she seems obsessed with the case.
Yeah. I mean, I think anyone that, yeah, I mean, and you know, you probably had these rules, Bob, like as a first responder, as a government worker, as a firefighter, like you are supposed to use those government work systems for work only, like very specific. Right. And sometimes our emotions get the best of us. And that's what I would chalk this up to. It's just like if a cop is like, oh, let me drive by my girlfriend's house. Oh, there's a car sitting out there. Let me run the plate. No, you cannot do that. I'm sorry.
Right.
Like, you cannot use those resources for your personal interest, not even gain, but like personal interest, absolutely a violation of the actual law. Not to mention the whole HIPAA records for sure.
What about the, because I don't know what should be done or shouldn't be done, but I know a big deal was made of the fact that she like gave all this testimony, but said that she destroyed her notes. She doesn't have notes about like particularly this confession.
Yeah. So I didn't find anything unusual about that at all. I mean, obviously she has some notes and it sounds like they were digitized and that was like, you know, the printout that had like the date for all of them. When we take notes, right, we sit in session and we usually jot down handwrite notes. You then take those notes and we have, you know, there are full software programs that are just for therapist notes. You then enter them in there and then you should shred your handwritten notes because you don't want those to get in the wrong hands, right? And our jot down chicken scratch will mean nothing to someone if they have to come back and look at them. So that's why, like, when you have time later, that's generally why therapy sessions are 50 minutes because the last 10 minutes are for writing your notes after you see a client. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely common. I will say, I mean, again, like we don't have the trial transcripts and we don't have the evidence. Like if those were just little short statements that she was picking out of her notes to answer the question, great. If that was the entirety of her note, those are not how therapy notes should be written. But maybe she wasn't doing therapy notes. There's also just like observation notes that she could be doing because she's not doing a course of therapy with him. It's so hard to say. Like Scott and I have tried to wrap our mind around it like every which way, because if you hear him talk about like, hey, yeah, in the county jail, your caseload is 200 people and you're like, hey, how are you doing? Okay, next cell. Hey, how are you doing? Okay, you're not like, you know, eating your feces. Okay, great. Next one. You're not like sitting down and doing luxurious therapy with people in the correctional setting.
Yeah.
So I mean, I can't speak to her notes because I just don't know, but throwing away the handwritten notes after you've digitized them is not unusual. It's what we all do.
Yeah. So that's, and I was asking because, so on my side, when I was a firefighter, particularly arson investigations, we were always required, our chief always had us, because, you know, that's how it would work. And obviously I've got a clipboard and a pen out on a fire scene. I'm taking down all my notes and I get back to the station and then I type out my narrative. I didn't I didn't copy the notes onto something, but I would use the notes to write my narrative to type it out. But then we always had to attach the physical copy of the handwritten notes to it, because if someone FOIA'd it, that they were entitled to see the handwritten notes as well. And I've gone through that with, you know, some cases.
Same with cops.
Yeah.
Same thing. We had to keep our handwritten notes.
Yeah. And with cops, it was the same thing. You'd FOIA'd it and sometimes we'd get them. But then I've talked to other friends of mine who are detectives and some of them would say kind of almost what you said, where they were like, you know, we would, after we wrote a report, we would always shred our handwritten notes because if someone FOIA'd them, then they would get access to all of our notes, which I've had arguments with them. I'm like, well, why wouldn't you want them to have access to your notes? And I get it. It's like everything on there may not be relevant. It's
totally like, you're writing down your lunch order in the margin, or like it doesn't make sense to someone. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a state law that you have to keep your notes. I think for cops, I think if they exist, then you have to turn them over. So yeah,
exactly. There is
that. But like as a therapist too, I think I want my notes, God forbid they get subpoenaed to court, to accurately represent what I was conceptualizing for a client. And sometimes that comes afterwards, right? Like you sit with it a little bit and you want it to make sense. You should see the bullshit of like what my notes look like. If my clients saw them, they'd probably be horrified. They'd be like, what?
Let me ask you this, Shiloh. If someone you were treating began a itemized confession about the crime for which they have not yet been tried, and you took those notes down, and I know this is a personal thing, because I agree that it does not necessarily nefarious to get rid of your notes, like it's not the same as firefighters or cops or whatever, but if in that case, do you see yourself going like, I'm going to treat this as I would any of my other notes? I'm going to take down this itemized confession. I will, of course, shred those notes from when I was actually sitting in the room with him, and I will write it up in this other way. Or would you have a different response, given everything you've said about, like, why would I even be in the situation where this would happen in the first place? But, like, does that feel different than a normal course of action with a therapist and their client?
That's such a trick question because honestly, like I would end the session, Janet. I would not allow them to
never be in
say
that.
I would never like. Yeah. They wouldn't get past item 1.5. I mean, right. I don't see a world in which I'm like, well, okay, I tried. Like, go ahead, spill your guts. No, like it's just,
right.
No, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that part of the reason where I guess I'll speak for myself why it's like frustrating for me she doesn't have it is because she ends up playing the role of a detective kind of, right? Like she's the person who interviewed him and got the confession. So my mind is like, well, I want to see what you were writing down when they gave the confession. So it's like, it doesn't feel like it's just a therapist's notes. It's like you sat there and like talked through this whole confession with him. So not that like that makes her not a psychologist, but I think in my mind, it's like you should be taking notes about that and turning them over because you're acting like a fucking detective, even though you're not.
I think that's what they call it is like an agent of the state. You now kind of become an agent of the state.
Right.
And if you're in a fact finding position, and that is wholeheartedly unethical and not our job at all. And now that I'm remembering it, you know, you said in the episode, the whole part about, and I feel so bad. Zach like actually started off this whole line of questioning and he never got to finish.
It's fine.
But the part about doing something with the gun, you know, you're like, who would say that, right? Like it sounded like she fed that to him. But isn't that exactly what the detective fed to him? You had to do something with the gun. And I'm like, that could have been Richard Allen's verbiage that he just got from the detective way back when, too.
He said you racked the gun. He said what he said in the thing was, I'll tell you what I think you did. I think you racked the gun to scare them. That's when the bullet expelled unused.
That's like what he gave him too.
Yeah, very very specific verbiage. Yeah.
Yeah. Zach, is that what did you want to talk about with as far as the confession?
So I wanted to go along those lines, but in this you talk about that who would say they did something with a gun? Not a gun owner, which I agree with. As a gun person, I wouldn't say that.
Right.
But can both be true? Can Richard Allen say that he racked the gun? And Dr. Walla is, as Dr. Shiloh said, has got chicken scratch and is going along. And she doesn't really know what he said or didn't realize what he said.
Yeah.
Great point.
She knows he did something with the gun. Now she has to relay that he did something with the gun.
Yeah.
So I wonder... Not that I'm saying it's true, but that there's a possibility that both could be true.
Absolutely. And that's kind of like the other elements of the confession for me, too. It's why it doesn't do anything. There is that unknown there. All I have to work with, you know, and that's what like there's people, I'm sure there's people listening to this right now that are like, fuck you, Bob, before you're even questioning this stuff, because this case is just that kind of case. But like, you have to understand what I'm saying is I'm trying to only look at the data that I have in front of me. Mm. And the only data I have is her saying that he said he did something with the gun. So for me, the only thing I can analyze linguistically is that, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, like that's, I don't think Richard Allen would have said, I did something with the gun. I think he would have said what he did with the gun.
Correct.
Is there a possibility he said, I racked the gun and she didn't know what that meant? So she just put it, he did. Absolutely. But I don't know that. I can only go off of, you know, what she said. And so for me, that because that's what I'm tracking with the confession. I get into it a little bit more in Sunday's episode, but that element of does this fit with the crime scene? And there's that, like, it doesn't seem like that's the thing he would have said. So I don't know if it's just something lost in communication, if she just made it up, if she fed it to him. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not claiming to know. But what I do know is she said that happened up on the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And that does not fit, you know, as far as like analyzing the confession, that does not fit. It's one of the boxes I'm trying to check. Does it fit with the crime scene evidence? It doesn't. I'll circle back to when Dr. Shiloh was on, when we were looking at the bridge video, you know, and again, this is, you know, we're talking about behavioral analysis. It's not an exact thing like, oh, well, because this is the impression that I got or she got or Janet got or you or whatever on doesn't mean that is what happened. But, you know, based on my analysis, and if I remember correctly, the way Dr. Shiloh kind of looked at it, it seemed like the girls had had a previous interaction with the bridge guy, maybe made plans to, you know, had a plan to go somewhere with them prior to what we see in that 43-second video. That doesn't fit with the narrative that she gave in the confession, mm-hmm. right? And then even the van driving by, which I didn't discuss in this episode because for whatever reason, that part wasn't in the article I was reading. But we've heard other people say that she testified that he got spooked by the van driving by.
Mm-hmm.
That fits with the trial evidence, but it doesn't fit with the original evidence. Because, you know, originally, the day after, Brian Weber testified that he got off work, clocked out at whatever time, 2-something, and then went and serviced ATM machines before he went home. And then after we get this confession that says, a van spooked me off, then the testimony changes to, I went straight home from work and I would have been driving by right at that time. I'm not about to speculate how or why that happened. I'm just looking at what was the original evidence that we have and does this confession fit with that evidence? And for me, it doesn't. It doesn't fit with it. I don't believe that he remembers better 7 years later than he did the day after.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
At the time that he confesses to Dr. Walla, that was April.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Mm-hmm. That's what her note showed. Was it public knowledge that there was a round found on the ground?
I don't know that it was public knowledge, but he had his discovery at that point.
Okay.
Yeah. So he, and she talks about that he had already had his discovery.
Yeah.
He had had the, and they've been communicating, right? Like she, you know, she's his lifeline. She's his human, the only human he's talking to. So
he could have read that in the discovery. So the source for her could have been him recounting it. The source could have been she looked at his discovery, but the source could not have been that she found it online because it was not public.
I don't think so. I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I don't think so. And that's the thing is like my inclination is always to like jump to like speculating on how that happened. Is it like he tells her that and that, like especially because that did something with the gun. You know, that if he's sharing what he's seeing in the discovery and there's this bullet that was found and she's like, how'd the bullet get there? Did you do something with the gun? And he's like, yeah, you know, but I want to make clear what I'm saying is like, that's like hypothetical scenario that I'm just, you know, coming up with as to how this came about. I'm not saying that's what happened, but it's just like one of the things, because a lot of it is for me is I don't trust Dr. Walla.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust her based on all the stuff we know about.
Well, I can remember
I'm sorry, let's take Janet's question further. And if hypothetically I was writing these as notes, I would absolutely write down quotes. And I write down quotes all the time in my notes, right?
Uh-huh.
You're going to know what I have sort of summarized, but you're also going to know what are exact quotes from my client lending to the picture I'm trying to paint of them.
Right.
So that should have been done, whatever was a quote and whatever was just like her verbiage. Sorry, yeah. Zach, go ahead.
So I've been in all the groups for a long time since the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And that came out very early. The whole gun theory came out very early that it was like, somebody heard the audio and you could hear a gun rack.
Mm. Right. You know? That's why everybody was listening for that.
So everybody was listening to it. But that came out before, I mean, like right after the audio. And that was the only thing we had was the audio.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it just popped in my mind. Yes, it was public. Because when he was arrested, the probable cause affidavit came out and it said the reason that they found him was because of the unspent shell casing.
Yep.
But it didn't say where it was, I don't think. Which might explain why it got explained to be up on the trail and not down where it was actually found. Sorry, Zach. Mm.
No, so that theory has been out there for a long time. And she could have got that online. Anybody could have got that online a long time ago.
Yeah. So to answer your question, yeah, all that stuff was public knowledge. And yeah, that the van was being talked about, not just the gun, but sorry, I was reading another comment too while you're saying that. But yeah, the van theory spooking him off had been discussed online a lot also before that. So that's the thing is it's like, where's the information sourced from? It doesn't fit with the crime scene evidence. It was easy to find online. It was easy for him to find. There's like three ways for him to have this. Well, not really. I was going to say one of them was going to be that he committed the crime, so he knows these things. But the things that, as far as what she said, he said, don't actually fit with the crime scene evidence. So that's not one of them. So it's like either he's making it up based on some little bits of information, or he learned this stuff from the discovery, or she learned it online. But the point is, in that room with the two of them, all that information was public.
I would love to see the trial transcripts to see if the attorneys, you know, the defense, when they examined her, were like, so were you sitting there quietly just taking notes as he was talking? Did you ask him anything?
Yeah, because that had to be come out and cross.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully soon. I can't believe that the trial transcripts still haven't been released.
Well, and you have to think, too, that's probably, out of the confessions, that's the confession that holds the most weight. That's the most damning confession.
For sure. Yeah.
But it's not directly out of his mouth. You don't hear it. It's not a written confession.
Yeah, so it's odd, right? Because you have, like, I think probably what held the most weight with the jury, from, like, somebody who's a completely untrained ear that's just listening to it, is hearing him say, I killed Abby and Libby.
Yeah.
Like, well, that probably, but from anybody that maybe studies this a little bit more, that the confession that would hold the weight is the one that has a narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what I mean. The him saying it is huge, right? And then you go through this narrative, which they know, right? He says, according to Walla, he said he led the girls across the bridge.
He followed them across the bridge.
Followed them across the bridge, cut their necks, and covered them with branches,
mm-hmm.
which we all know at this point is true.
Right.
So that holds a lot of weight, especially if the evidence has been presented that that's what happened.
Right. Yeah. And Janet, I'm hoping the answer is no. Do we have a whole lot more questions that we haven't already gotten to? Because we're now an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely want to acknowledge, you know, Valeria and Garrett and some other folks had some thoughts that were really interesting, and they very much kind of fall in line with what we've already talked about. So any additional questions that we didn't get to, I hope that you feel heard, in the sense that we've been at this for quite some time, and we did a touch on a lot of questions. I mean, Garrett had an overall question about really just what you asked Shiloh some time ago, which is just like, what do we make of all of this? And the continuing question of like, what does everyone think? Do they think he's guilty, or do they think that he is not guilty, but might be guilty, but still shouldn't have been convicted and all of that? And I think, and I don't mean to dismiss that, Garrett, but that's something that I think we come back to a lot. Like almost every episode, but and we continue to say, like, we just don't, I don't know. I really don't have that strong of an opinion about.
So this, I think that leads perfectly into a nice segue into my closing, which is you're going to get my opinion on that in Sunday's episode. So what I've done for Sunday is I've kind of taken a step back. Now we have, you know, we have the Bridge Guy video that was released, you know, Libby's video that came out. We have the interrogations. We have the confessions. We have some information about Dr. Wallace. We've analyzed all this and every step of the way with an expert along the way. And so I've made one episode where I've kind of packaged all of that together and shared what my opinion is on the case based on the actual evidence that we have up to this point. So it just kind of just like putting all that piecing it all together and kind of what it means to me. So that's what we have coming up on Sunday. Dr. Shiloh, I want to thank you so much for taking time, rushing home to get on with us today and the last time. And make sure you tell Dr. Scott, for I've told him to, but let him know we thank him for all of your expertise, because it's really important to me, because all of this, you know, I've been doing this a long time and a lot of people want to hear my opinion and Zach and Janet's opinions on it. But I am very conscious of the fact that while I've done a lot of this and have done it for a long time, I am far from being an expert. So it's always really meaningful to me to have somebody come in that actually like is an expert in this field and whatever field we're talking about to share their opinions rather than just me yammering on. So thank you so much for all your time and effort into this. And as always, Zach and Janet, thank you guys for just being here and being a part of this and keeping me from yapping for 2 hours straight every week. And with that being said, I think after and now an hour and 20 minutes, we're just going to, you beat Dr. Scott's record.
Oh gosh, he's going to be really upset. And that's shocking, by the way. Shocking.
In our defense, we had one extra person here this time. There was four of us.
Okay.
Yeah. With that being said, we love all you guys and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.